If your business needs a new application, then developers will have to write code, a lot of code. If an application needs to be modernized, then you'll need time, resources, and caffeine. If that sounds daunting, then you need Watson X Code Assistant, AI designed to multiply developer productivity so you can generate code quickly. Let's create a more modern foundation for business with Watson X Code Assistant. Learn more at ibm.com/codeassistant. IBM. Let's create.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from iHeartRadio. Everything ends. Jeff Bezos has said that Amazon will eventually go bankrupt. Some believe Apple will also go out of business. And my guest today believed that we may be nearing the final days of the Fox News empire. Michael Wolff is the author of The Fall, The End of Fox News, and The Murdoch Dynasty. Journalist Michael Wolff has been a publishing powerhouse for decades. He is the author of 11 books, including The Man Who Owns the News, Inside the Secret World of Rupert Murdoch, the preeminent biography of the Fox media mogul. He's served as media critic and columnist for New York Magazine, Vanity Fair, British GQ, The Hollywood Reporter, and The Guardian. He's also the founder of the news aggregator website Newser, and the recipient of 2 National Magazine Awards. He now has another accolade to add to that list. He's the first repeat guest on this podcast. I first spoke with Michael Wolff in 2018, live at Town Hall in New York City, to discuss his number one bestseller, Fire and Fury, Inside the Trump White House. This week, Michael Wolff and I return to Town Hall for a live conversation about his latest book, his writing process, and his unique brand of journalism. Please join me in welcoming my guest, author Michael Wolff. Now, it occurred to me, because you know everything about these subjects, that I wanted to go a different direction and not talk so much about the book and the Murdochs at first. I wanted to talk about your methods and your techniques in writing. I thought about that famous quote by Janet Malcolm that accompanied The Journalist and the Murderer, that article she wrote for The New Yorker magazine. Quote, "Every journalist who is not too stupid or too full of himself to notice what is going on knows that what he does is morally indefensible. He's a kind of confidence man, preying on people's vanity, ignorance, or loneliness, gaining their trust and betraying them without remorse." Now, when you begin a project and you're interviewing various people, you must have your methods and techniques. You make a list of people you want to interview. There are obvious people you want to interview.
You know, I think it's different from that. I've been doing this for such a long time that I'm around. I'm just always there. And people cease to notice me being there. And actually, I think that they find... Sometimes I think that there are two me's. In one, people, and often very powerful people, they find me to be... the soul of discretion. I become a kind of confident. I mean, they like to talk.
They want to talk.
I like to listen. You know, I have no animus toward them, like many other journalists might. I have no political bone to pick. I'm just there. I'm just listening. I'm like a palace reporter in the court of whoever, Murdoch or Trump or what have you. And people get used to me being there. And then
they let down their guard.
They let down their guard. They treat me like I'm supposed to be there. And I think that they think that I'm have their best interests, or that I'm somehow we're on the same plane. And then I go home and the pen starts to write, and it doesn't necessarily align with that other person who was there before.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how you say you were there. Yes, you've been doing this for a long time. And I find that that's a component of human nature. I had a couple examples. One where I went to go meet the head of a studio. And I went and sat with this guy at a restaurant in L.A. And I did something that I rarely do, is I didn't say a word for an hour and a half. And I let him do all the talking. And no matter what he said, I was so engaged. I was like, no, you're kidding. Did they really? And he just went on and on in an unbroken monologue for an hour and a half. I go home, and my agent calls me. He goes, what did you do? I go, what do you mean? He goes, he loved you. And people want to talk.
It's all you have to do is listen. When I did my Murdoch biography, and this was set up, and there was a lot of talk, and, he finally agreed. And I showed up for the first interview. I showed up and we spoke probably for quite some time, an hour and a half, perhaps. And at the end, he said, have you gotten what you need? And I thought, the world was going to end. I mean, this was, and I said, I have some more questions. And I remember he got up very slowly from his seat and he went around behind his desk. And he wrote me into his date book for the next week. This little thing went on for 9 months. At the end, it was always, have you gotten what you need? And then once I said, I want to go see your mother.
Which he objected to, right?
He didn't object. He said, well, why do you want to do that? What's she going to tell you, that I was an okay son? And I said, well, and she was 99 at the time. And then he said, okay, I get it. You need a color graph. That's an old newspaper man.
Now, when you go see his mother, when you're in the early stages of this, obviously Murdoch's been around for a long time. He's been a famous media magnate and so forth here in the UK or, Australia, what have you. He's been around for forever. So where does it begin? Like, when you want to talk to him, do you kind of warm him up and it's like small talk and it's some biographical questions? What's the method when you sit down with someone like him?
It's to supply him with a piece of gossip.
Right.
That was his. It's like you can see, like he's the fish. And then he just goes for it. And so you had to have a piece of gossip. And, so I was showing up every week or sometimes twice a week, and I didn't have that much gossip. So what you could do is just make it up. It didn't make any difference to him. He appreciated it as much.
Right.
And then I would often find that you would make up a piece of gossip, and then 48 hours later, it was all over town.
Right. Now, when you say you make it up, is there an art to making up gossip you feed to Rupert Murdoch? Is it like Biden has a secret Canadian family, or what's the gossip in line with? What's it?
It was like Michael Bloomberg is going to buy the New York Times.
Right.
Michael Bloomberg is going to buy the Times.
Yeah. Get ready.
And then that became a rumor, swept everywhere. That was so. It's curious because Rupert then gets on the phone because he's a newspaper man. And so he starts to spread it, and then people start to call around and ask if this is true, and suddenly it's everywhere.
But isn't it funny how you say that? I went to the book party with you the other day, and you're in a room full of people, all of them, many of them the highest levels of the most elite media in New York, books and publishing and the Times and so forth. These are people who write for the Post or something, And they're there, and what they all have in common, I found, what I thought they had in common was this idea where they just crave information. They are obsessed and addicted to information. Everybody they talk to, you literally see them moving. How do people move around a party? Especially when they're all, these kind of highbrow, well-educated, very smart people, and with these really, really important positions in media. And you see them moving around. What they do is they go to different groups of people and they mingle, and they're like, any new information here? No? Next, gone. They're there to cull information. They want to learn things. They want gossip. I mean, they want gossip. So you take advantage of that fact.
Just make it up.
Just make it up. What was it about Murdoch's childhood and how did he grow up that you think prepared him? You know, a lot of people I know, he came from a pretty privileged family. You know, they were well-to-do.
Yeah, I mean, he came from the most privileged family. Right. I mean, he grew up in Australia, in Melbourne, and he was the absolute aristocracy of
his father.
Of Australia, which was a kind of otherwise level nation except for Rupert Murdoch. His father ran the most important media company in the country.
Right. And so was it just predestined that he would go in that direction? Did he ever have any kind of wild oats he had to sow? Or was
he did. He didn't really get along with his father. He went to Oxford, you know, had a bust of Lenin, and his father had to send emissaries to say, you know, shape up, kid. And then his father died, and he inherited... His father actually didn't own the media company. This was a company owned by its investors. And all Rupert was left with in the end was a single newspaper from there 70 years later.
Now, to get back to your own bio, if you will, you were born in Paterson, New Jersey.
I was.
And you graduate high school, I guess it's around 71. Roughly.
It was.
And so you're kind of post, we're in kind of an interlude there in the civil rights movement of the 60s, and Kennedy is killed, and King is killed, and Nixon becomes president just 3 years before. Did you have a period of where you were involved and you were an activist? Were you political when you were younger?
Well, I was in high school, so my parents wouldn't let me go to demonstrations.
Right.
So
they wouldn't.
I think I was... I once wrote a piece about Christopher Hitchens, who claimed to be, you know, who was a 60s activist. And I said, hell, no, wait a minute. He was 12 at the time.
Well, he tried to spread some gossip that wasn't true also. So. He just was trying. Now, but when you get out of high school, 70, when you go to college, where do you go undergrad? Because you went to Columbia graduate school, correct?
No, I was an undergraduate at Columbia.
What'd you study?
History.
So history. And was writing something that was on your mind?
Yeah, I went to work for the New York Times when I was a junior at Columbia.
To do what?
Starting at the bottom, the guy who fetched the hot dogs.
Did they eat a lot of hot dogs at the Times?
No, they did. That's all they ate in those days.
Yeah.
And they looked it.
They had yellow skin. Now, when you leave the Times, how long were you there before you left to go to New Times?
I was there for about a year. I hated every second
now,
of it.
Now, why? Because I figured that the Times is probably, especially back then, a destination for most writers. Why did you feel comfortable just walking away? What didn't you like about it?
The smoke. There was so much smoke in the news. And it was so gray. It was all men, and they were gray men. And they all had tics.
Facial tics. Oh, yeah.
I mean...
Well, hot dogs and cigarettes will do that, too.
I mean, it was like... And you had a vision. Oh, my God, the rest of my life could be here.
Yeah.
And when I told them that I was going to leave, and I had done, you know, in this time, you know, quite well. You kind of get these promotions, and you begin that you can't sit down, and then you get a seat, and it's vaguely Dickensian. And I said I'm going to quit, and they were like, well, you can't quit.
Yeah.
What will you do? Well, you know, I don't know. I'll be a try to be a freelance writer. And then they would tell you how much money a freelance writer made. And that was your fate. So you had to stay.
You're going to eat spam.
And I was like, I just can't. I just couldn't stay another minute.
Now, when you leave the Times, describe for people who don't recall, what was New Times? It was a new magazine.
Yeah. When I got out of, when I left the Times, it was a fantastic time in New York. There were independent magazines all over the place. An old editor of mine, John Homans, who died 2 years ago, used to describe this as the late renaissance of the magazine business. It was a fabulous time and place. People paid you rather well, and there were, you know, if this magazine didn't want your piece, then that magazine would want your piece. You could just kind of go up and down Madison Avenue and sell your wares. No, it was a fantastic time.
Now, describe for me, because you write your first book. Your first book was published what year?
1979.
Oh, so it wasn't that long. You were very young when you published your first book.
Yeah, 25. It was a book called White Kids.
About? Need I ask? Is it about white kids, literally?
Yeah.
Or?
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah, it was about, I was early on to the, you know, making fun of white people.
You were. During this period, I would imagine you're hopscotching back and forth. But I mean, once you become an enormously successful writer, I would imagine books preoccupy all your time. But we'll get to that in a minute. The difference between writing for books and magazines, how would you describe that? You wrote for so many big magazines, and you're getting a commission. They're telling you what to do.
Yeah,
you're pitching them how to work.
It's not that different. You know, you're sitting there by yourself for a rather extended period of time. But it's a similar thing. You're telling stories in a similar way. I mean, it's a narrative form, you know, beginning, middle, and end, which a magazine piece, that's what a good magazine piece is too. Now, the important thing to realize is that magazine pieces were different then. You know, these magazines had singular voices. You know, you opened these magazines, and that was the great thing about magazines, and you entered a world, a kind of, you know, these extraordinary and kind of complete worlds. You know, I often describe it is that the successful magazine, they build a world like a kind of club, which you read it because actually you feel you are not in the club. You know, you read Playboy magazine because, you know, it made you feel like everybody was having sex but you. You read Rolling Stone and you felt that everybody was incredibly cool but you. In Vanity Fair, everybody was super glamorous but you. That created this real formula of entering, building these worlds. There are still these brand names around, Vanity Fair. That culture just doesn't exist anymore. And people who made their living in that culture don't really exist anymore.
Well, now everything has shifted because of digital and everything because of online and the expediency of the... So now the Times is like a magazine. You pick up the newspaper to get a deep dive on a story, and a magazine is like a book. You know, you're really going to sit down and spend 2 hours reading the New Yorker magazine. So the way that the digital imperative, the way that online news sources have just pushed everything into another bin is kind of horrifying to me because you don't... I'm of a generation now where I think... You're never going to get the facts online. I mean, almost impossible from some venues. And also, my perspective is that when I was younger, it was like 90% facts and information and news and 10% opinion. And now that's been flipped. You read articles in The Atlantic, good writers. You read articles in all these places. And it's a lot of opinion and this much fact, you know, and I find that appalling.
I mean, that's partly because opinion is cheap. You don't have to do the reporting on opinion. You don't have to.
Good point.
You don't have to find yourself, you know, much of the opinion is about the Trump era. And that's easier than actually finding yourself in the Trump White House.
Now, you have 3 books in a row about Trump. Your last book, 2 famous, The Rich, The Powerful, The Wishful, The Notorious, The Damned, was about, quote, monsters, media whores, and vainglorious figures, unquote. And now Rupert Murdoch. You spend a lot of time with unsavory people.
I get along with them.
They're my people.
My métier, yes.
Right, they're métier. What's it like for you? Many of the ownership class, who I'm friendly with some of them, or I'm friendly with somebody who knows them, and I go around these people, and they all admire Murdoch to the hilt. Number one in New York, money is money. If you made a big pile of money, people admire you, you know, unless you're a criminal. And even then, they might tip their hat to you now and then at a party. But Murdoch, I mean, I'll never forget, there were friends of mine who I thought politically they would at least not express any positive feelings about Murdoch. They all admire Murdoch deeply. Did you get that sense?
Yeah, well, what are they? They admire him because, not really because of the money, but because of the power.
Right.
And the power is the currency of our time. Who has the power?
Right.
Who has more power? I mean, having more money, nobody really cares about that. It's what, do you have the money to buy more power? In the late 80s, Murdoch at that point had already established his effective empire on newspapers around the world. He had bought 20th Century Fox. He had started the Fox Network. He had bought Sky Television in the UK. And I had actually proposed a biography of him then, and no one was interested. He was a kind of low-rent sleazeball. Why would you want to write a biography about him? 20 years later, and so much in the culture had changed, then suddenly I made the same proposal, and that was, this was now a seven-figure project with everybody bidding on it. So something very, very clearly had changed in the way we would regard people like Murdoch, who otherwise, if you strip it away, is just a tabloid publisher. He contributes nothing and has ruined many things.
Journalist Michael Wolff. If you enjoy conversations with astute authors, check out my episode with Sam Wasson, author of The Big Goodbye, his book on the making of the movie Chinatown.
What was it about Evans that he wanted to have great films that made money and won awards?
He loved it. He loved it. He loved show business. He loved movies. He loved people. He loved talent. It's actually that simple. I asked him this question. I said, Evans, is it as simple as you bet on talent? Do you have an easy job? And he said, you're goddamn right. It's true.
To hear more of my conversation with Sam Wasson, go to heresthething.org. After the break, Michael Wolff shares what kept Rupert Murdoch from acquiring CNN.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
If your business needs a new application, then developers will have to write code, a lot of code. If an application needs to be modernized, then you'll need time, resources, and caffeine. If that sounds daunting, then you need Watson X Code Assistant, AI designed to multiply developer productivity so you can generate code quickly. Let's create a more modern foundation for business with Watson X Code Assistant. Learn more at ibm.com/codeassistant. IBM. Let's create.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Author Michael Wolff is known for infiltrating some tight circles, from gathering information at cocktail parties and martini lunches to being a fly on the wall in Trump's White House. The result is three books on the Trump administration and two on Titan Rupert Murdoch. Yet from time to time, he's received some criticism from the media on the veracity of his reporting. I wanted to know how he felt about getting under the skin of his fellow journalists.
I think most journalism is kind of crappy. I think it's boring. I think it's repetitive. I think it's kind of sourpuss literal. It's humorless. It's and no one really has much interest in character or apparently much ability to express what character, what makes someone what they are. You know, I think it's also more and more journalism is a negotiated reality. You make deals with the PR people, or you have to negotiate with the institution that you work for, and everyone works for an institution. So it's lawyers, editors, layers of editors, often fact checkers. And in the end, you know, it's a kind of a committee product. And I kind of, not to be too highfalutin, but I try to make a distinction, at least for myself, between being a journalist and being a writer. You know, I'm interested in you know, why people do things, how they got to be who they are, how they talk, how they smell, how they roll. And maybe in the end, the big difference I see between myself and everybody else is it's just me. I don't work for a company. I don't work for a, it's on the page, you just get me. And you can be assured of that. It's not something else. It's not some other committee.
I find these things interesting because I didn't pick up on this. I watched chunks of Succession. I didn't really binge that show that much, which people indicated to me was somewhat about the Murdoch family and their dynasty. Did you watch Succession?
Yes.
You did?
I did.
And did you see, knowing as well as you do the Murdoch schematics, did you see the Murdochs vividly in those portrayals?
No, it isn't. I mean, it's about a Murdoch-like structure, right, of a family.
Right.
But, you know, the Succession guy is a kind of bordering on violence all the time. Rupert is not like that at all.
Right.
Rupert is incredibly mannerly, courtly. You'll be received in the most gracious way. Tucker Carlson was describing this to me, his relationships with Murdoch, and pointing out the same thing. It's so nice to be with him. And then Tucker said, of course, he's a savage, but you never see that. And the savagery is always carried out by someone else. He himself is incredibly conflict averse. He doesn't do that, anything to avoid a conflict. You know, within the company, they say, one of the best things to do is to be hired by Murdoch, because then he would pay you a lot of money. But they said, but even better is to be fired by Murdoch, because then he would really pay you a lot of money.
Do you recall, how was Fox News received when it was first launched? And were they as ham-fisted in their right-wing viewpoints from the get-go?
I mean, first thing, what Murdoch wanted was, he had tried to buy CNN. They wouldn't let him buy CNN. So
they being in the government?
No, they being CNN.
Okay.
I mean, the owners of CNN, you know, just kind of rebuffed him because he was still regarded as a kind of a low-rent sleazeball. So he said, you know, damn them, and I will start my own news network. And he hired Roger Ailes. And Murdoch is a cheapskate, so it was, you know, it was starting this network on the cheap. But it really was not about any particular political viewpoint, I mean, other than, you know, the general Murdoch tabloid sensibility. And it was Ailes who came in and said, no, there's this unserved audience, and we can serve it with a kind of...
So Ailes is more responsible for the DNA of the network than Murdoch.
I mean, Murdoch has literally nothing to do with the creation of Fox. It's Ailes who says, you know, let's just serve up kind of... I mean, Ailes said to me in one discussion, he said, you know, this was in, I think, 2016, somewhat before he died. He said, you know, the people, you know, they live now. They live in 2016. He said, the people I program for, they live in 1965. You know, and that's that kind of thing. You know, he built the network, which really looks like television from 1965.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like that kind of daytime quiz show television.
Joe Pyne.
Well, it's that, but even more, it's more the you know, the girls, the graphics, whatever.
Right.
You know, it was...
The girls meaning the correspondent, the blonde Fox types.
Yeah. And then he figured out you could, you know, Ailes is a political guy. He figured out that politics was actually kind of, you know, narrative drama. You could monetize politics. Politics is conflict. Just emphasize the conflict and it becomes irresistible. And people tune in, and soon enough, it's the most profitable news operation that there has ever been.
Exactly. They're the envy of everybody in that industry, people who will admit it. I had a little brief moment where I was going to do an interview show for MSNBC, and I was sitting there with the people that ran the show over there, and I was talking about, you know, simple things like my sets, what kind of set would we have? And I said, I'd like to have it be a little bit different from, you know, I said, most of your sets are like some Soviet police station. They're all like white and everything's lit really brightly and everybody looks like shit. And I said, I'd like to do something a little bit differently. And I'll never forget, we were having these meetings and I wasn't saying the right thing to engender the love of the people I was going to go work for. And one woman who was a longtime producer walked up to me outside in the hallway, and I'll never forget, she said to me, she goes, I need to tell you something. I go, what's that? She goes, everybody here used to work at the mothership, meaning NBC, regular news, broadcast news, network news. And she goes, now we're over here, and we're all getting paid. And she said, and nobody's watching. There's a pause, and she went, so, shh. She said, stop complaining. Like, we're here doing a job, and this whole game is rigged by carriage fees that they pull off when they kind of give people the poison pill of MSNBC. Murdoch's children, was it inevitable? Like, did James Murdoch always kind of indicate to people he was going to go the way he went? And was it inevitable that Lachlan would prevail?
No, it was seesaws back and forth and has for nearly 20 years. But the interesting thing is, okay, that this is set up and this is the succession. What is not true in the succession, the key point here is that Rupert Murdoch cannot pick his own successor. He bargained that right away on his second divorce. He got divorced in California, community property state, could have sundered the empire. Instead, his then wife, Anna, made a deal, $100 million, virtually a tip at that point, if you'll freeze the trust for the existing children. That means no other children can, if you have other children, which he did, they can't be part of the trust. And you can't change the terms of the trust. The terms of the trust is when you die, there are four votes that will determine what happens. So he agreed to that. And then ever since been stuck with this. He can't appoint his successor. That in the end, it will be the decision of his four oldest children. And that alignment has shifted.
Isn't that like succession? Wasn't it a big part of succession, them jockeying to succeed the father?
Yes, but he always had the power to appoint
to
someone.
Decide. Can you imagine, you don't get, your next crop of children don't get any piece of the action. And so he's having dinner with Wendy Dang, and he says, I've got to tell you that our children, if we were to have children, they wouldn't be able to inherit any of my fortune. And she's like, let's skip dessert.
This actually happened. And then she...
I mean, that's gossip I made up. I learned that from you.
I mean, she threw him out. It was a thing. And then he had to go to his other children and say, you know, literally on bended knee. And
give him
that
a slice.
Bended knee is I will give you... They didn't have any real money because it was all tied up in shares. He said, I'll pay you.
Cut them in.
I'll give you money if you cut in your...
Half-siblings.
Your half-siblings. And they each got $50 million, and they cut in the siblings.
That's all?
Well, then, yes. At that point, that was it. I mean, they would all, since after that, get $2 billion. But anyway, they cut them in, but they didn't give the new siblings any kind of vote. So they just get the money.
Yeah, let's be reasonable. Here's $50 million, but just keep your mouth shut. Yeah. Now... what surprised you, if anything, that you can say about Murdoch that you got to know about him? What surprised me was I learned during this research that he supported Obama. Is that true?
He did.
What do you think that was about?
Well, he supported Obama because Obama was going to win,
right.
Number one. But number two, you know, enormous pressure from his children. You know, his children are, you know, we're like, you know, okay, Obama. I mean, this is a, you know, the
momentous occasion.
The world is changing. We have to do this. This is important. And we should be there. And so, you know, Murdoch is, you know, begrudgingly, okay, you know, it's just, I can hear the mumble now. And he did it. And he sat down with Obama. They got along. And he did it. I mean, he supported Blair in the UK. This is not unknown territory for Murdoch, who's going to, you know, I mean, the first and foremost of all his political positions is who's the winner.
And then after that,
go to the power.
It's, you know, yes. Then it's like, you know, okay, who's the, you know, who's gonna protect my money more?
Right. Now, you spelled it out for us that a lot of the decisions that involved Fox News was Ailes' territory. So is Ailes the one that hired all that talent?
Totally.
Ailes is the one who identified Hannity, O'Reilly.
Yeah, Murdoch is not a television guy. Murdoch doesn't even watch television news. You know, he can't sit there. He gets up, he leaves the room. He's not a television guy, certainly not a television programmer, not even a television executive. So this was entirely Ailes' business. And, you know, Ailes once told me that Murdoch had made a vow. They had a written agreement that Murdoch would never interfere. Now, Murdoch has made that written agreement throughout his career and always broken it. But he did not break it with Fox because, A, it was television. I mean, he always broke it in terms of newspapers because he could put out a newspaper better than anyone, at least he believed. But he never felt that way about television. Plus, and on top of that, it was making so much money, unbelievable amounts of money. Even for Murdoch, it was staggering and breathtaking.
Sure. Now, someone told me that not all the people who are these stars, if you will, the leading lights of Fox News, really believe everything that they're engaged with on the air, like Hannity or whatever. I mean, I've always had the lowest opinion of these people. I've always said that Hannity was a guy who, like, you fill in when somebody, like, drops dead at their desk, that somebody's in a studio at Fox and they drop dead, and Hannity's like a janitor there or something. Like, get in the booth, kid. You're doing the show tonight. Like, he just fell into it. Because, I mean, to me, Hannity has
a roofer. He was the roofer. O'Reilly always called him the roofer.
The roofer. But the point is that someone told me these people don't necessarily embrace everything that they say on the air. Is that true?
Well, it's television.
Right.
You know, I mean, who embraces everything they say on television? You're there to cater to an audience on whatever network.
So it doesn't necessarily reflect their own feelings.
Yeah, I mean, you're there. You're going to maintain ratings or you're going to be fired. Somewhat the difference is at Fox is that the ratings are even bigger than everywhere else.
There's more money.
You're going to get more. You're being paid more money. The response is more intense. So you're on the program.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, the last couple of questions I want to ask you are about media in general. And that is, you know, we live in a world now. When I was a kid, it was an appointment to watch the news. It was 6 o'clock, Cronkite, Huntley, Brinkley. We had a relationship with media, and the world wasn't pulsing us with news. You know, now you have a device in your pocket, and you're able to find that everything in real time in an instant, and much of it bad. And much of it, something more importantly, that you can have no hope of influencing whatsoever. And I'm wondering, which was better? Was it better then when we could consume news and think about it, but it had its place in our lives, in my opinion, and then we lived our lives the rest of the time, you know what I mean? Or the way we live now, where we live in this hot tub, we're in the fucking hot tub all day long, the news, what's happening? And again, much of which was, what are you supposed to do about it? What are you supposed to do about it?
I actually think it might be something more complicated than that, which is that most people don't listen to news. I mean, remember, people get their news from cable news. These are audiences of, I mean, Fox will do 2 million a night. You know, CNN will do 600,000 a night. These are relatively small numbers.
Under a million, yeah. It's CNN does under a million.
Yeah. I mean, these are small numbers compared to the news that you're talking about when it was 20 million or 30 million.
Yes.
A night. So we have that kind of thing. News is more intense, but servicing fewer people. But then we have this other side of this in which people are involved with this political culture, but they don't really follow this political culture. It's more a point of identity than it is of information or events or anything that we would otherwise have associated with politics.
Murdoch is old. Murdoch is very old.
I got a call last week from the Daily Mail. They said they were running down a rumor that we've heard Rupert is dead.
We did that on 30 Rock.
Yes.
Don Geist, they put him in the freezer, ripped torn. The point is that when Murdoch is gone, I mean, he's alive now, and who knows how much he has his hand in things now, even though he's retired.
Yeah, well, he hasn't really retired. You know, that was a weird retirement. You know, I'm not going to step down. I'm going to step back. What does that mean? I'm going to step back. What it probably meant immediately is that he doesn't want to testify, looking for a way out of testifying in this other big case, the Smartmatic, another voting machine company, right, that when they're suing for, I think, $2.7 billion.
Emboldened, no doubt, by the...
And he can't testify when he, you know, the deposition that he gave in Dominion was a catastrophe. So they're trying to get a workaround when
he really is not stepping back, but he's gone. I mean, in terms of not passed away, but eventually, I guess he won't. Maybe he'll find a way to have an influence on the company after he's dead. Who knows? But he. But what do you think is going to happen? His kids just don't seem to have the same skill set he does. Is that fair?
I mean, they're rich kids. They each have, as I said, $2 billion in their pocket. So that creates a whole different sense of motivation, clearly. Lachlan now runs the company and wants to hold on to his job. James, his brother, wants to take the company from him. I will take the company from my brother. I will turn Fox News into a force for good, air quotes.
Author Michael Wolfe. If you're enjoying this conversation, tell a friend and be sure to follow Here's the Thing on the iHeartRadio app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. When we come back, Michael Wolfe answers listener questions from our audience at Town Hall in New York City.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing Watson X Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with Watson X Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. I spoke with Michael Wolfe live at Town Hall in New York City about his latest book, The Fall, The End of Fox News and the Murdoch Dynasty. Before he answered some questions from the audience, I couldn't help but wonder if Wolfe is aware that he resembles, curiously, his book's subject, Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah, no, all the time.
They tell you all the time, yeah.
Yeah.
Because vaguely you do,
it's incredible.
I wonder if that was part of him trusting you, because he thought he was talking to himself.
It's so disconcerting.
He trusted you.
I think...
You liked the way you looked.
He sort of would look at me sometimes and kind of notice this, and I said to him, I said, you kind of look like my grandfather. He says, your grandfather? He says, I look like you.
I love this. Steve from New Jersey. How can Fox News save itself? Or can it?
I mean, it's a funny question. That presupposes that Fox would want to save itself. Fox believes it doesn't need to save it. It is the
winner.
Yeah. But, I mean, James Murdoch does probably have the votes or could possibly have the votes to take Fox and to turn it into something the opposite of what it is.
Really?
How he does that, and he would have to do that on the back of his shareholders' money, which would probably not make them happy. But he could. He's a decent television executive. He ran Sky News, which is a pretty down-the-middle product. Yeah, it could happen.
Marissa from Brooklyn asks, would you go on Fox News to promote your book if you were asked?
You know, this is an interesting thing in that not only am I banned from Fox News, and this is a Murdoch thing, but they can't say my name on Fox News, which has spared me a lot of grief. Because that whole part of the world doesn't know that I'm, you know, not in agreement with them, that I write books about Donald Trump that they probably would not like. Which, as a matter of fact, and I can tell this, here's the last time I saw Rupert Murdoch. This was in 2016. I had been visiting Roger Ailes, whose office was on the second floor. And I came down on the elevator. I was alone in the elevator. And the doors open in the lobby, and there's Rupert Murdoch, and here's me. Now, Rupert and I had spent a year together, so we were extremely well-known to each other, and we had not spoken in a long time because he hated my book, and we're looking at each other, and we don't know what to do. I mean, it's like both of us. And I finally put out my hand and I said, hello, Rupert. He throws up his hands so as not to have to shake my hand, charges past me into the elevator, 2016, knocks my shoulder as he goes by, and then I step out and think, well, that went well. I got another elevator story. I'm on the elevator. This is in 2009. I had just spent the morning with Murdoch in his apartment in this building. It was a Trump building on 59th and Park.
The Trump Park Avenue.
Where Ivanka and Jared lived. So we're talking and having coffee, and then we leave together. We get on the elevator, go down a couple of floors. Elevator stops. Elevator doors open, and Donald Trump gets onto the elevator with us. And Murdoch greets him in a friendly, neighborly way. And Murdoch is just an incredible mumbler. You know, first thing he talks into his head, he's in the next Donald. Trump turns to me and says, do you ever understand a word he says?
A rare moment of insight by Donald Trump. Last question is from Don from New York City. How do you know, I love this, how do you know when or if your sources are bullshitting you? They're just making it up. How do you know?
I mean, it's a good question. And I guess the answer is, well, you don't. But you become very close to these people. I mean, this is not just, you know, I'm calling somebody up and saying, can you tell me, blah, blah. I end up in long relationships with these people. And this is people within the Murdoch circle who I've now known for years and years and years, and people in the Trump circle who I've now known for, well, since 2016 and over the course of three books. So you kind of come to understand who they are, what their agenda might be, and then also the test of time. When they told me that then, did it turn out to be true? Or how true did it turn out to be? And that's sort of the game, the inexact science of what we do.
This is my last question. I'll use one example, which is the FinCEN regulations, the regulations that prohibited for many, many years network television from producing their own programming. FinCEN, which was killed by Clinton, of all people, because supporters of his in media wanted it to be killed because they weren't making enough money. The network television audience was eroding, so they needed to be able to be more competitive, so they needed to be able to produce their own shows. So you have NBC launches NBC Studios, ABC Studios. They're going to make their own product. And when you put a show on NBC, I'm not going to pick on them, but any network you put a show on, what they demand as their vig to put your show on the air is become appalling. Like it was, like you used to give the networks 25% of the profits at the back end of the show, then it went to 50. Now I think it's like 65 or 70. When you come and work for them and they control the network, they pocket a lot of money now to even put you on the air. It's like what Paul Newman told me about shelving fees. So one of the problems was when he sold Newman's own products, he had to pay payola to the supermarkets to put his stuff on an eye-level shelf. You don't want your stuff down here. You want it up here at eye level. And you have to hand them a check for $250,000 to that store to put your product on the right shelf. So all this hocus-pocus that these companies do, FinCEN, the fairness doctrine, the government has become non-existent in regulating media in this country. Do you think that's a problem? And if you were to make a change, a regulatory change in media today, what would that be?
Well, the background now is the media business is collapsing. The television business is collapsing. Mm-hmm. The movie business is collapsing. So all of this stuff, the controls, not controls, whatever, is at this point kind of immaterial. Mm-hmm. We are Good going point. Into a period of radical transition, out of which, I mean, no one yet can imagine what the shape to come is going to be. I mean, it is going to be very different. And what will media will be
right.
Something other than what we think of it now. Other people will be in charge than those now. You know, Murdoch, he is both lucky and smart. And based in 2018, basically sold off most of his company. I mean, he got out of the entertainment business. Mm-hmm. 20th Century Fox, mm-hmm. All the cable stations except for Fox sold to Disney
right.
At the top of the market. And matter of fact, the only things that he kept were things that Disney didn't want. He would have sold those too, mm-hmm. but they didn't want Fox for obvious reasons, and there were other things they couldn't take for regulatory reasons. But Murdoch being Murdoch, understood, you know, let's take the money and run.
Let me just say this, which is that I can't think of anybody in my lifetime who's had more of an influence on our society and our culture than Rupert Murdoch. When I grew up, we lived in a world where there were political opinions you had that were not very measured, they were very volatile, they were very, very bitter, they were very, very judgmental, they were harsh. And you kept those opinions to yourself. The society that I grew up in terms of media and people on TV, there was a kind of there was a professionalism to them that was just, this is absent today. And what Murdoch did was he unleashed the monster, if you will, of Fox News, just encouraging people to complain and bitch and not solve any problems. You know, these people are all about destroying. They're not about building anything. All they do is destroy everything in their path. And I want to say that an understanding of that in terms of how that happened and who the person is who's in charge of that, Murdoch, I'm so grateful to have you with me because this is a wonderful book, and I encourage everybody here to buy this book and read who is Murdoch in a historical context in our lives in terms of media and our country and the world. This is a great opportunity for you to learn about that by reading this book.
Well, if I can just add, it is sure. Also catching him at this moment, the inflection point of a good story like this, of having a man who has devoted his life to amassing this level of power. More power, more influence for a longer period of time than anyone in our age.
I think
age.
That's not good for our country.
And then,
liberal or conservative.
Yes, and then, but here we catch him losing it. And that's when you really start to see who someone is and the pathos, the tragedy in its own way of what you can't take with you.
Well, I want to say this is our first repeat customer. This is our second interview here at Town Hall about his book. We did Fire and Fury before. A huge, look at me, huge book. It's amazing how you do somebody for a while and you don't stop. I mean, even my wife said that to me. I'll sit there and I'll go, I want to go to dinner and I want to have dinner, maybe some Japanese food. And my wife was like, will you stop? I mean, what's wrong with you? You know what I mean? So anyway, I want to say thank you to the great, great, great journalist and writer, Michael Wolff. Thank you so much. Thank you.
My thanks to author Michael Wolff. This episode was recorded at Town Hall in New York City. We're produced by Kathleen Russo, Zach McNeese, and Maureen Hoban. Our engineer is Frank Imperial. Our social media manager is Danielle Gingrich. I'm Alec Baldwin. Here's the Thing is brought to you by iHeartRadio.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.